Welcome to the Magic Hour, a safe haven for lost stories and curious folk. So, I have some quick housekeeping and updates for you. Rudo has taken a sabbatical from the podcast, and for the remainder of season two, I will be running the show. Also, the Magic Hour will be releasing only one episode a month for a short while, and I'll let you know when that changes. I also just wanted to remind you that the Dreamcast lives on Substack, and it's a great place to share your thoughts if you're inspired by one of our episodes. So stop in there if you'd like. And finally, if you feel like you ever have a story that you'd like to share in the Dreamcast, please reach out. We'd love to work with you. Because the thing is, this Dreamcast is all about finding our stories, our epic myths in plain sight. We want to hear yours. And now, let's start the show. Hey! I'm so happy to introduce this next guest. He's a dear, dear friend who I met way back at SUNY Purchase. His name is Chris Hall, and he hails from Massachusetts, and he lives in a magical cabin that he is going to tell us about. He has many hats he wears. He's a poet, a public historian, a park ranger, and a caretaker of a historic house. Chris tells stories and brings the past into the foreground. He has a lot to share, and I'm excited for us to chat on the Dreamcast. Welcome, Chris.
Thanks, Jess. I'm excited to be here.
I'm excited you're here, too. So the first question I wanted to know is, honestly, how long have we been friends? Because I've been trying to figure that out. When were we at Purchase? Like 2000-something?
2002? The number I use is 20 years. I don't know if that's a true number.
I feel like it's around there. It feels like many, many lifetimes.
It really does. It's about three or four lifetimes, which is, I guess, why I'm here.
Yeah. And there was a period of time where, like, we didn't talk for a while and then we reconnected. And so, and then recently last summer, I actually visited you for the first time in a really long time. And that was amazing. So, so cool to have friends with such, you know, all that time passing. It's pretty cool.
Yeah. Great to pick it up.
Yeah. So I wanted to start with just you telling us a little about yourself, about your origin story. Like, who are you? Like, starting from when you were young. Where are you from? Things like that.
Sure. So I'm from a suburb just south of Boston. And I went to public school there. Eventually went to SUNY Purchase. And then I moved to New Jersey, back to Boston, where I am now.
Like full circle, kind of.
Yeah.
What was your childhood like?
A lot of music. Music as soon as I could, you know, before I knew how. Played in bands and whatnot. Kind of played in bands all through college. I still play guitar and mandolin today. So that's been my one constant. And kind of through different bandmates and some kind of weird teachers, you know, the cool teachers in high school, I got into poetry.
Ooh. Yeah, I know the weird teachers. I'm one of them.
Yeah. That's so true. I didn't even think of that. Oh, I love that. That's so good for the world.
It is good for the world. The weird ones. So, like,
the world needs weird teachers.
It really does. So, like, why music? Why do you think that was your foundation as a child? What's that about? Can you put your finger on that?
The boring answer I have today would be I'm an audio learner. You know, I find out that I have ADHD. Addressing that, you know, while I was doing some grad school and figuring that out, put a lot of things together. And ADHD and music goes together quite often. The other answer, though, I like is just, you know, that, like, the rhythm and the notes, it's like my first memory. It, like, blew my mind open. And I was always after more and something new. And every time I learned that adults have record collections. They might be small, they might take up a whole room, but there are albums there. There are CDs, cassettes. And I learned that whenever I went to a new adult's home, visiting with parents or what have you, even old people, like I would be like, where are they? Where are the records? And, I would con my way into leaving with an album or just by sheer excitement.
It's amazing.
Some of the real music lovers enjoy that I did that and would make me mixtapes based on what I was into. And then it became a way to meet people, to socialize. I was traveling once with a friend in my early 20s, and we were really roughing it, and we met another group of people just because this one kid had a band shirt on that I knew. And this is something that I would never have thought twice about. I mentioned it, we strike up a conversation. Not only do we become friends and travel with them, but that guy then moved across the country and dated my then girlfriend's sister. And I
Wow,
had a
so it
friend
like
be
opened up
like,
all these doorways.
yeah, a friend told me it was a superpower, it was like a skeleton key. And I guess in a way it
Cool.
was.
Music is a
Yeah.
skeleton key.
For
Well, you
me,
are a
yeah.
poet, so that makes sense. Yeah. That's amazing. That's such a cool. So it really is like the bones of your growing up. It's like the structure.
Yes. Yeah, and then
So,
at some point I heard Bob Dylan. And Bob Dylan was the linchpin from music to poetry. The lyrics were unlike anything I had really heard before. But what drew me in, honestly, because I knew the serious songs were serious and there were serious things about them. But it felt like when you read Shakespeare as a kid, sometimes something good is happening, but you don't know what's going on. Bob Dylan, a lot of people don't know, Bob Dylan's very funny. Very funny. He's still really funny. And he has a lot of
Interesting.
funny songs on these very serious albums. And they just made me crack up because they totally cut the tension of the seriousness. So that kind of drew me in and got me relaxed and got me used to his language, and then I could concentrate and take in the bigger, more serious songs. And I would read everything about him that I could, sort of in the same obsessive way that I would stock houses and as a kid for like records and whatnot. Every magazine, every scrap of paper, it was early internet then, whatever I could find. And I always like reading about people's influences, and he being very influenced, particularly by Allen Ginsberg. I kind of found Ginsberg at this time in high school where another overlapping thing is happening. I had a friend who was experiencing initially a euphoric, but like schizophrenic breakdown.
Gotcha.
And if you've ever been with someone who's in that, the first part's amazing. And we would walk in the woods, and he told me I was a poet. He was obsessed with William Blake, and otherworldly things, things like the Doors of Perception, and the William Blake, along with kind of being coached that like I know how to recognize the otherworldliness of things, I guess. The beyond, it like sparked something in me that was the same as music. And I had played music with this guy before, so we already kind of had that. And I got into Allen Ginsberg and William Blake at the same time, and those two overlap. I got into the Beats, and I became president of my school's poetry club eventually. But just going to poetry club every week, and everyone reading original poems, and just keeping a notebook, and every little weird thing you think of. Now we have them as like even like tweets or status updates or something. Those little it's a natural way to think, and poems would come out of that, and just little journaling, taking in the world. All that was going on.
That's so beautifully said. Didn't aim, headed away message. We
Yes,
do think that way, don't we? But it's essentially poetry. It'd be interesting to make a poem out of a bunch of people's away messages or something. I don't know. That's a really interesting way of thinking about it.
No, my first notebook, I forget, like, I would, when I went back and looked at it, I was writing as if someone was going, as if it was public, as if someone was going to find it. And it was, it's a little cringy, the material, because of that, but it's what we might do online now. It is public, it's not just our deepest thoughts for us.
Yeah, you kind of wanted to share it.
I guess
You
so.
kind of felt like you wanted to share it. Maybe you weren't sure, but you had this comp maybe, I don't know if compulsion is the right word, but like drive to maybe be seen, maybe.
I did, but I think I was also scared. This is me realizing this now, scared that someone was going to find it. So it was like I was addressing someone reading it, even though no one ever did, except for a few people maybe. But eventually, you move into that more private space of a notebook once you get a little more comfortable.
This might be hard to remember, but do you remember any of the poems from that book? Or like, is it totally ancient now? Do you remember any of them that stand out?
There are not that book, but from that period, there were some eventually that I read in front of the whole school. Which I can't believe I did that in high school, but and it was well received. No, there was a poem called, it was right after 9/11, and if people remember, there were flags everywhere, just very nationalistic overnight, and it felt overdone and eerie. People wanted someone to pay. And at that point, they didn't know who it was. So I wrote a poem called Pathos for Samuel. It was about, like, I remember now, the refrain was like, uncle, dear uncle. I was being very deep in high school about Uncle Sam. Apparently, that one friend told me there were these two kids, like, sitting next to each other. One kid was like, "Was Chris abused by his uncle?" And the other guy was like, "Shut up, it's symbolism." But we got everyone out of class, so maybe that's why everyone was receptive to it.
You got everyone out of class?
Well, for an auditorium, like a high school,
Oh, so you like read it on a stage.
Through Mr. Collier's poetry club. Mr. Collier and Mr. Tart, those are the two English teachers. And
So I should have added in your intro that you were also the president of your high school poetry club.
I forgot if I mentioned that.
That's amazing.
I kind of became accidental too. I just went more than anyone, and then the woman, I guess the girl then, who was stepping down, just said, "Do you want to be president?" And I looked at everyone else. I was like, "Well, does anyone else want to be president?" And They were like, no, you should be president. I was like, okay, president really do anything, but that maybe help get me into SUNY Purchase.
Right. And so I feel like this is a nice transition to kind of when we probably met, and poetry kind of, it wasn't how we met, but it was kind of something. There's a story about your writing that I wanted to share. If that's okay if I share that
Sure.
now. Can I share that now? So you go to SUNY Purchase, you're going for English, right? And I'm there for art, so I'm an art major. I ended up actually being a history minor later, but I was an art major at first. I was drawing and painting. And I think you and I did take a creative writing course together. We were in a class together, I think.
We took a
But
poetry
you,
course together, yeah.
yeah, but you wrote a poem and you actually weren't at school anymore when you wrote it, right? You were actually visiting.
Right. The
It was like the
context of
next
this
year.
poem is Jessica and I and some of our friends, Rudo, Dave, we all met. I liked hanging around visual art people and film people. And we just had the euphoric, stereotypical freshman year. And then I decided to take a year off and save money and go backpacking. And I came back. Like, I flew back from overseas to New York before going home to Boston. And I stayed with you guys at Purchase. And it was college, so a year, so much happens and changes. These days, now, 20 years later, like a year can happen in the blink of an eye. But when I arrived back, I had been through a lot just in my year. I worked blue collar jobs and like a bookstore in the shipping department and just moving boxes to make money. And then I just like traveled all over very, very cheaply, sleeping in places I would never sleep now, having kind of a stereotypical experience. I was trying to find William Burroughs in Morocco. He was dead. Like I walked on the castle made of
Sounds like a
sand in Essaouira, Morocco.
it sounds like a something a poet would do.
I guess so. Yeah. We got invited to a Moroccan English class at a high
What?
school. Yeah. So we were in Morocco, and my friend went into a convenience store and was trying to purchase water by speaking French, because a lot of people speak French there. And the 16-year-old kid behind the counter said, "You don't speak French, you speak English," kind of giving him shit. And long story short, we got invited to go to this high school English class. And we get there, and the teacher is really excited because at that point, it was just after 9/11, and people were scared of Muslims. So people were very excited that, like, Americans were, in a smaller town in Morocco. So the teacher just gave us over to the class, and the teacher said the kids could ask us anything. And this one kid raised his hand, and you could tell he was serious and he was going to be the brave one to ask a serious question. And he asked us what we think of the Iraq war. And I asked them, I said, "It's bullshit." And I was like, "Do you guys know what bullshit is?" And they all shook their heads. The teacher got really excited again. And he jumped up and grabbed a piece of chalk and wrote it on the board and said, "I was telling you last week about American slang. This is real American slang."
I did not know this story. This is blowing my mind. So you're in Morocco. Oh my God. That's
Yeah, so
amazing.
that was.
That's what you were doing that year. And like I was still with all those friends at Purchase and I was going through a bunch of stuff too. And my life was totally changing. I was in a lot of hard things had happened.
Yeah,
And so you
briefly,
come
what was
back
going
from this
on?
like it's not, it was a bad boyfriend's friend had passed away. It was post 9/11, so I always feel like things changed dramatically post 9/11, just in general, like the way we view the world. I think our generation has permanently changed from that. And so, like, and by the way, our school was like an hour from there, you know, so like, you know, it was just in our face.
When I returned, at the moment when I write this poem.
Okay.
So I returned to Purchase. That's when it was a weird period in time. It's right when Abu Ghraib happened. You remember Abu Ghraib? It was when the American
familiar, but I would
soldiers
need a reminder.
It was an atrocity where they stacked prisoners naked in the pyramid.
Yes,
the famous picture
this.
Of the hood. It's all torture and abuse.
Like, I so do remember this. I'm still upset about it. Yeah.
That's the world that you and I were in. It was like that day it was announced.
Really? Okay. Yeah. Yes. And I remember that, just to remember that golden, I'm calling it the golden freshman year, where we were all whimsical and like playing in the woods and going to fun concerts. And it was a unique time.
I went barefoot a lot.
Yeah. That's just a lot of,
oh God.
We were just wild. We were feral. We were like, you know, we were in wonder. Or whatever,
and we were babies, you know. Then, we were babies.
Yeah, and when you look at pictures of us, it's unreal, right? And so,
it should be stated that Purchase was also an unreal place. Like, there was this band Doofus that we all connected over that had 30 people in the band in like life-size puppets, and it was when you could live in Brooklyn for like $5 a month. So everyone around us. Because SUNY Purchase was this incubator of an artsy place. Langhorne Slim, I would see perform at open mics every week.
I remember that, yeah.
Just Dan Deacon just would do not even like these alien performances, like speaking in alien voices and interviewing people as an alien, and that was the concert. Like, weird. And now some of that stuff changed culture. So that's kind of... Also, we were in that in a special time as well.
We were. And, you know, something that you and I have talked about is people are always changing, but you came back to a different version of me.
Yes.
And it's funny because I do not remember you going away. I feel like we were all in our own worlds, kind of. But I remember you giving me this poem and... It meant something to me at the time, but it was really when I pulled it out when I was an adult later. I had it in a box. I was like cleaning out all my stuff and I was in a totally different era of my life. And I pulled it out and I think I cried. Like, I found it and I realized what it meant. It's crazy how one piece of writing, and it's only a few lines, how one piece of writing can have so many layers to it. Because I think intuitively you and I knew what it was about. But we didn't really know. Now, looking at it in retrospect, we've understood it better. And I think I've talked about this before on the podcast. I think a lot of times as artists and writers, we're wiser than we realize we are. It's like you almost have premonitions and then later you understand. I don't know if you know what I mean.
Yeah, it's like, you know, when your mystical friend tells you you're a poet and you didn't know. It's like all of that.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. Right. And so I'm going to read it. And so it is framed, and now it's up in my home. It's called Poem. 1. I'd never seen you wear black before. You're alive. You know that. Of course you know. It's no surprise. It's just that dealing with death and the long run makes it worthwhile. I'd tell you, but you know. You live it more sincerely than I can write. 2. Today you are right. I was right.
Yeah, wow.
It's a great poem.
I forgot.
And
about
I get a little teared up just reading
lines.
It.
Yeah.
Because I was like all glitter and fairy, and then you came back and I was like, I was still glitter. I've always been glitter, but I was wearing black and I like dyed my hair black and I was goth for a little while. And
yeah,
I was dealing with some stuff. And you were like, what? And I wasn't happy. So it was true. But I was still there. I've always been me. I was just going through something. And I think to younger people, when we're younger, it's scary to watch the people we care about change. And you reminded me of who I was. And I think that in some ways that poem has probably become, it has become like a mythos for me, because I turn to it when I feel lost and I'm like, don't forget who you are. It's like something that's been a North Star for me a little bit. All from you handing me this thing.
Yeah.
Back at Purchase.
I'm glad I did that. Because at the time, I came back and it felt like everyone had changed, and not only changed, but moved on, and I was left behind. Yeah. And
right,
you saying that if you didn't even realize I was gone, I felt that from everyone. Yeah. Like, I didn't feel like it was offensive or personal, which it was even scarier. It was like, I'm somehow drifted way over here and no one's noticed.
I wish I had noticed. I wish I'd had more presence of mind.
And, you know, I wish I had had more presence of mind too. You know, but that's also where a lot of the poetry came from, is dealing with that gap. I realize that now.
Do you feel like it's a way to cope too, to process the world?
I'd say so. One, yes. Yeah. My other English teacher, Mr. Tartan High School, he had us read all kinds of poetry from the Harlem Renaissance to the Beats to I forget what, but quite a bit. And a lot of the poems were people dealing with life. And he would ask us, he would ask these leading questions. What can the person do about this problem? And it would always end up in the same way. Like, it doesn't seem like they can do anything about this problem. And he would say, no, there is something they can do, and they did it. They wrote a poem about it.
Wow.
And, you know, I forgot about that until now, but I think that stuck with me as well. It's just like, there was a lot of things I couldn't do anything about, and a lot of those things became poems and was kind of the channel I put poetry through.
That's really powerful. And so that's the start of our friendship and of your journey into the next part of your life, because you leave Purchase and you transfer to UMass and you get your English BA, correct?
Correct.
Ultimately, that's what you do. Yeah.
Yep.
And what was it like there? Did you like it? Was it just like you got it done? What was the vibe?
Well, the vibe was that my high school friends, all of whom had had some kind of similar experience I had with feeling distant at wherever they went to school, a big group of us all transferred and then lived together, and we all kind of felt like we were, I don't know, hobos. We all kind of felt like we'd fucked up, and now we were at just this huge state school that felt rather anonymous. We ended up playing in bands and partying a lot, and there was a lot of anger I had, I realize now, Jesus, and other people had, I think, just from that. It's immature now when I think back on it, but like that out of control, you know, life doesn't just go like you thought it would. And it's so obvious and dumb now when I think about it, but I didn't really get it then. But
that's what I was going through when you wrote that poem.
Yeah.
I was very angry too. I can totally relate. Yeah.
Did you know you were angry?
I think so. I think I knew I was playing into a trope, a dumb, like, melodramatic trope, but it felt appropriate. It's like you just find this place to be for a little while where you get to explore your darkness and how disappointed you are. I was mad at my family. I was mad at life. I was depressed. I was dealing with some mental health issues. Like, I was going through a lot. So I think that age where we were, probably early 20s, you know, late teens, early 20s, that's really when that happens. The world hits you square in the face and you're like, okay, what the hell? And you have to process it.
I call it a second puberty. It's a mental puberty.
It is.
And you feel like it's never going to end. And I remember at that point, people I know were starting to go to therapy, and I was kind of like, oh, maybe I should do that. And then it just never happened until the last semester at UMass. I did do therapy. And it was very helpful.
Did that help you? Okay, yeah. I was in therapy the whole time.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, and I've been like off and on in that. And recently in grad school, I got like learned some new things, which I guess we can talk about when we get to that. But that was the beginning of a new understanding I was trying to have. Because there was also an awareness that the real world is not going to stop coming at me.
No.
Just because I can party, I can be angry, I can deny its existence. You know, I can say it's these artistic other worlds that exist, but like that world was happening whether I wanted it to or not, and I didn't want it to. But it's just part of that mental puberty, like in your 20s.
Yeah, I keep thinking as you're talking that it kind of settles in, and then you're like, okay. And your brain matures, because keep in mind what we know about the brain. It doesn't really, I don't know if you remember how crazy it felt being in our bodies when we were that age, but something clicked when my brain fully developed and I was able to actually deal with things. And instead of doing what you said, like just finding any possible way to distract or rage against, instead you kind of process it and find ways to either to like both make change, to take care of your environment that you can affect. You slow down and you are able to make more change, or to like exist better within it and accept where you're at. Because I think when you're in those early teen kind of second puberty years, you're like, this is not the way it was supposed to be.
Yeah.
You know, and you're resisting it the whole time. And you learn from therapy and mindfulness and all that stuff that that's not going to get you anywhere. And so you become more wise, I guess, you know.
Yeah, you're on your way to learning there's no such thing as supposed to.
Yes, and it also get more balanced.
I didn't really get there. I gradually got there, but I didn't really arrive to anything close to that until I was about 35, until I transitioned into the history room world. And it was like a journey into the unknown. I didn't even mean to get there. But I graduated from UMass.
Yeah.
I had just started dating a girl I'd been friends with for about a year. And she goes back home to New Jersey.
Okay.
I go back home to Boston. It's 2008. So the stock market has completely crashed.
Okay.
And I'm doing the thing I was told to do of like, go and ask them if they have any jobs, which like is already dying out. But every older adult around me said that's why I didn't have a job. You know, I ended up working briefly at like an antique store or something.
That's cool.
I bar backed, but even those jobs would dry up because other people who worked there got their friends part of my job because the economy was so bad. I worked at an antique store. I went from working every weekend to every other weekend. And then the same thing happened at my bar backing job because someone's cousin needed a blah, blah, you know.
Right.
And I'd be talking about it to the girl I was still talking to, I guess dating, but we were, you know, not serious. And she said, well, you've wanted to get into publishing. Publishing is in New York. You know, why don't you move down here? Her family had an apartment next to their house, like half an apartment, really, and moved in there. And they were, that family was great. I've nothing like that family was very kind and generous to me. And me and the girl at the time were just of we just didn't know how to we didn't fight in the same way. And we were just I had never been in a relationship like that before. And I thought this was like when you get married. I was like, well, I graduated college, so like that's kind of, but like I didn't know about the work you had to do and like how
Right.
it
It's
was
hard.
foolish, like but
Yeah.
whatever. So with the
That's how you learn.
best intentions, yeah. But and but
Yeah.
it was also stressful because economics were so stressful. That's the
Right.
other thing. We had no money. Like I overdrafted like several
Yeah, I remember
times.
doing that a lot too.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Remember having like $6 in your account?
It gives me nightmares.
Yes. Yeah. Now having a savings account, it still
Yeah.
amazes me.
Yeah, same.
So like there was just a lot of added stress that like did not help things. Like that, who knows? Maybe I'd be married to that girl if like things weren't as like nearly as stressful.
Yeah.
But I ended up eventually getting an unpaid internship, and this took me months. And at this time, for like real internships that would get you careers,
Yeah.
the richer families were paying money to companies for the opportunity for their kid to work for free. So like that's what we're up against.
So bizarre.
And I got a job at a place that mainly, it was an agency that mainly represented like theater actors and published some scripts and some cookbooks. And it was just, it wasn't a, the stuff I was dealing with wasn't a good fit for me. But everyone was really nice. I did great things. But what started there, this publishing agency, one of my duties was to go through the unsolicited submissions, write rejection letters to anyone who addressed a specific agent and anyone who just addressed the agency, who had sent packets of books. It was my job to throw it all in the trash. Like, manuscript after manuscript after manuscript. My job, my duty was to either write to them and say no, because you, in order to get representation, you had to have a professional recommendation from someone in the industry already. And these people were just cold calling. I remember there was this one spec script someone wrote about 30 Rock, and Alec Baldwin had told Tina Fey's character that she had to keep an egg as if it were a baby for a week and it couldn't break. Like just these like fake 30 Rock script. I also got just movie ideas from someone in jail written in pencil or pen.
Oh my God.
Just all parts of society, people who have those ideas and they're writing to these agents to try to get their ideas made. And it just comes from all sorts of people. And I was just the killer of their dreams. I was the gatekeeper of
Oh.
death for these manuscripts.
Oh. It sounds like
And
something out of 1984.
yeah.
Something really.
And now that
Wow.
maybe I'm being dramatic, but it did something to
No.
me. And this continues on to more jobs. Because I wanted to work in with books. That was my thing.
Yeah.
I was like, if I'm with books, I'll be good. Because I really had no fucking clue what I should
Yeah.
be doing and like what I
Yeah.
was good at.
Yeah.
But like no one tells you there's like mass graves of manuscripts and that someone has to dig a place for them. Like,
Yeah, and someone has
and
to throw them
that's
away and burn them up, basically.
yeah.
Yeah. Is that when you wrote? Because you said you published a few poems. Is that when you did that? Is that around that time?
At that point, no. At that point, I had not published. But what happens? But I'll be soon. I'm still writing at this
Okay.
point, and you know I'd done readings and whatnot. I was always very good at poetry readings, like, 'cause I would, it kind of helps with the history job I have now, but I wasn't publishing. But I could always engage with the audience. If I read at a bar, the bartender always bought me drinks. It
Wow.
was, yeah, it was just some, I don't know. I guess I hammed it up or whatever. But
You're a
anyway, no, I was
bard.
not.
That's what I said. You're a bard.
There you
A
go.
modern day
There
bard.
you
Yeah.
go. Drunk as a poet on payday.
There you go. Nailed it.
So, long story short, that internship ends. Nothing comes of it because there's no jobs in society.
Kills your
Relationships
soul a
falling
little bit.
apart.
Yeah.
Yeah. In relationships falling apart, I've been working at Barnes and Noble again, working around books.
Yeah.
Eventually, though, I got stuck in the cafe. I wanted to be around books, and I go home every night smelling like steamed milk.
It's not terrible. It's not the worst possible thing.
I just still have. It was like years before I could drink a cappuccino again.
No, I got you. Yeah, that makes
But
sense.
I eventually the relationship collapses.
Right.
Everything's collapsing. I moved back home to Boston to my parents' house. My sister just
Oh,
graduated.
no.
So it's a full nest. There's just tension, and there's tension.
Yeah.
But as I'm doing temp work, just like at colleges and offices, just whatever weird temp work, and I was feeling very empty. And through a friend, I met someone who worked at this amazing used bookstore in Inman Square called Lorem Ipsum Books.
Ooh.
And I went there after a while. And I told them I wasn't leaving and they didn't have to give me any money. But basically, I was like, I'm volunteering with you. And I would just do sort of the receiving type work I was kind of doing, just like basically anything behind the scenes. And then eventually someone left and I got to be a clerk. And when you work, Inman Square is in between Harvard and MIT. And it was a cool place to be at the time. It was far enough away from public transportation where things were cheaper at the moment. Things aren't cheaper there anymore. So
Okay.
there was a big arts community.
Right.
And you got to recognize neighborhood regulars. And the bookstore was a place you could hang out for free for hours. So we got all the hangers on, good and bad. And you're there by yourself, and people bring in their books. You evaluate them, you give them store credit, you talk to them, you build up relationships. And it was run by this dude, this MIT dude. It had been run by two people. One, someone who specialized in books and bookstores, and this MIT dude who developed the inventory technology and some organizing systems. When I got on, the person who did the books had just like left the business, and the MIT guy got some way better job. So he was absentee. And in a lot of ways that sucked, but in other ways the inmates ran the asylum. We just like ran this bookstore.
Wow.
We put on concerts, we put on art shows. I got published in the Inman Review at that point. That was a journal just for the people in that square that was published out of the bookstore because we gave people space. At one point, the bookstore got a letter from the city of Cambridge, a very sternly written letter.
What?
We were operating an illegal cabaret.
What?
An illegal cabaret was the law on the books that we were breaking. And,
How? You weren't a...
by their standards, we were. Well, we were selling beer, we weren't checking
Oh.
IDs. We started off having poets and people playing an acoustic guitar and kids sitting on the floor. But word got around, it got bigger and bigger and bigger. And it culminated in this band, Slut Ever, this awesome band, Slut Ever. We just had punks spilling out of the store. There's so many people. And there were these kids who, may or may not have been underage. And they were just like drinking 40s and smashing bottles right outside. And we were like, hey, you can drink in here. Like, You don't, but they just want, it was like, it was a
Wow.
scene at that point. And
You made a scene. What did you guys do when you
yeah,
got the letter?
we toned things down a lot.
Yeah.
Yeah, we brought the tone down. And
That's
yeah,
crazy.
I held to my own way. Other people really made the scene. People who are doing,
Yeah.
big things that, like, no, I don't want to take credit for all that. But those people,
Yeah.
yeah, they were just so nice.
That sounds really cool.
I got to be published in a small magazine, but the people
Yeah.
around you had read it. And but at the same time, it was also like people would leave quote unquote donations at the door of books we didn't want to take, like big stacks of them. And I called them the firehouse babies. It's like someone leaving a baby in the firehouse, except it was my job to take those books and put them directly into the trash.
Again, with the killing of the
So
books.
many we I threw away so many books. We just because at some point we didn't have space for them. Whole basement full of books, chock full, and they just keep coming.
Wow.
And eventually there was it got to a point where we didn't have room in our 10 huge recycling bins. And I just remember looking at it, like knowing all the work that went into every one of those books.
Yeah.
It started to get me down.
Yeah.
But then at that time, I got a job that was more in the line of what I thought would be a career. During that
Okay.
time period, I was trying to figure out what to do with my life, like
Of course.
career-wise. And I,
Yeah.
again, the book track, I decided I would go to library school for a graduate degree.
Okay. That makes sense. Yeah.
I did not get in. Honestly,
Okay.
most people who apply to something like that get in because they know what they're doing, but I was still a little lost.
Okay.
And the I got a nicely written letter from a professor I had talked to there, and they just said, just go get more experience. They were like, you're going to be able to do this, but you need experience in the field because you don't have any direction. And I did not have any direction. I didn't have anything
Wow.
specific I wanted to do at library school. I was like, just let me work. I wanted to work in the library, and I
Yeah.
knew that to do that, a lot of people go to library school.
Right.
It turns out when you go to graduate school, you have to be a little more specific than just
Interesting. Okay.
like, let me in. Yes, I got a job as a contractor working for the Internet Archive, archive.org, inside the Boston Public Library, digitizing.
Okay.
Now I'm
Interesting.
going to say, I also want to mention everything I mentioned in this podcast, especially like are just my opinion. Anything I say about past, present, or future employers, strictly my opinion and do not represent the ideas of anyone else or any entity or company.
Yes,
I
definitely
like
noted.
everything the Internet Archive does. Front facing, back facing, it was the same model as like an Amazon on a much smaller level, but you had to turn a certain number of pages per minute, and you had these big glass book cradles and the foot pedal to lift up the piece of glass, turn the page, bring the glass down. Two cameras above you would take the picture, and you had to do so many pictures an hour.
Wow. Didn't even know that job
And
existed.
it was amazing. Like at the time, I got to. I did. Sometimes you would. A lot of times you'd be doing yearbooks and town records and boring things.
Okay.
I got to digitize a second edition folio of Hamlet. I,
What?
for the first time ever, held John Adams's books in my hand. This would change my
Wow.
life. And John Adams' books in my hand with his notes in the margin, and we had to document very carefully those books. I remember being like squished bug in page 85. So it's just amazing. Books, from the 1600s, 1700s. And I felt the ghosts, I felt the spirits in me, like they were
Yes.
alive. And this is closer than I'd ever been to where I wanted to be, which is with these old books that had, like, not only what was written in them, but who made them, who put them together and why they were there. It just felt right. Now, those were the books we were doing for posterity.
Right.
Other places, libraries were full. Some books hadn't been looked at in 50 years. Some books, all the foredges were together. A foredge is where one page meets the other and it's not split.
Okay.
So basically, wow. There's pages hidden inside, they're stuck together.
Whoa.
So I had to take either a knife or a very thin ruler and cut the edges so I could get into the material. But that meant never looked at that book before. Sometimes that book was over 100 years old.
Wow.
And it was just so weird to me that someone had, granted, there's a lot of copies of these books. This might be over traumatizing it, but at least this copy of this book had sat there for 100 years. And what I was doing is taking apart the foredges, and then once I digitized the book, breaking the spine and tearing it out piece by piece, putting it into the recycling bin.
So you were doing that again.
Yes.
You were getting rid of books again.
Over and over again. I remember the first time, like, I couldn't get a book photographed. And I was trying not to break it. And my boss, I told my boss, and he walked up. He was like, this is all you're going to do. He took the book out of the cradle, and he cracked its spine like you know, a disillusioned hunter cracks, like, twists a rabbit's neck. I just remember the sound. I remember the sight of the binding giving away. And he was like, we're throwing out these books, so just get the pages. It doesn't matter how you do it. And it was just like, fuck. Like, all this was playing into, why would I publish these little poems? Like, what's the point? It was like an existential crisis. It
I
wasn't
got
that
it.
Writing
I got
the
it.
Poems. Yeah, it just started. Like, because here I am again, like, just these throwing away. Now these books are sometimes 100 years old in the trash.
And you're just, like, that's where my poems will end up, in the trash.
Yeah, exactly. Yes. Yeah.
If I could make an observation, because this is a really riveting story. Like, you have all these stories. You're trying to find yourself, what you want to do. You get multiple jobs. You have to destroy manuscripts and destroy books and throw them out. But the first time you've spoken since childhood in music and Bob Dylan, like you've talked about with passion, is when you're holding these books in your hands, like the John Adams book, and you're connecting with history and you're feeling life, I guess, through the pages. But then you're also still having this darkness of the reality of what happens to books. This is what you get behind the scenes. You get the wonder of these books, and you get the end result a lot of the time. That's a really crazy journey to be on, to try and, even thinking back to the balance of being alive, having to carry both the wonder and magic and the darkness, like the reality of both. Like, that's a wild ride. That's hard, but kind of cool at the same time.
Yeah, no, thank you. Thank you for pointing that out, because sometimes I can't think about it. It's good to talk about it like this, because
yeah,
I tried to process it, but I can't really think about it too much because it's just weird. Yeah, and I never made that connection between the albums, but I'd have the same feeling as when I would, like, search into, you know, my parents' friend of a friend's attic I've gone into to dig through their, like, 8 tracks. You find something and you're like, it's the thing that has a spirit in it. It has wonder. It's captured this otherworldliness.
And
yeah, and then you just throw it out.
We're a generation too of going to the bookstore and getting a book. And I think there's a really sad transition our generation had to go through, which was the digitization of everything. I remember getting rid of all my CDs, you know, and putting it all on my iPod, and I liked it, but there was also something sad about it. I also like the tactility of books, but when you think about how many are made, I mean, yeah.
Yeah.
I think yeah. Some of them are going to get thrown away. And maybe for our generation, it's harder to watch that happening, you know, because it feels like such an integral part of our existence. I don't think there's a wrong or right answer. I just think it is. I think it's, that
right.
sounds like
and
a painful thing to experience. Yeah.
I eventually worked in nicer archives where the
Yeah.
job was preservation. And you know, I learned about philosophies of what we keep and what we throw away. Sometimes the
Okay.
reason why we're throwing these away is because they exist safely in many other places. So it's like
Okay,
I've
so you've
kind
got some
of,
context. Okay.
yes, eventually, yes.
You feel better now? Do you feel a little healed from that time now that you have context? Do you?
Yes, and I think less loss in life as well. I think both things.
Yeah.
But yeah, so I eventually hurt my back, and I could only do half the job, the computer stuff of the job. I could no longer
Okay.
do the like manual labor part of the job, which basically meant I had a target on me, and
Oh.
certain rules started to be enforced a lot heavier, you know, when they want you to leave.
Yep. That's
And I
nasty.
no longer had that job. You know, they
Okay,
treated people
gotcha.
like numbers there.
That's
And
terrible.
one time, because we were all poor, I was making like $11.50 an hour, and I like, you know, living with like freaking four people or whatever in a basement apartment. And that company, because there are different of these stations all over the country. The Mormons volunteer because they bless the books. They bless genealogy books as they're digitizing them because they believe that
Wow.
you can baptize people after they're dead. So like the company was
Right.
like, yeah, you can digitize their books. So, you know, they weren't always like they were doing nothing illegal, but also the ethics didn't always sit right with me. But it's just a shit show, and they had a contest between some of the branches over a month period who could scan the most pages, and everyone
Wow.
on staff would each get $50. Now, it's not a lot of money, but $50 was also a big deal then. Like, you could have a
Yeah.
night with $50. You
Yeah.
could go on a date with
Not
$50. You know,
anymore.
you could pay a bill
Yeah.
with $50. You could pay your credit card a little bit. Yeah, not anymore. But it pumped us up. We did it as a team. And then they just like weren't giving us our money, like the head
Wow.
office out in San Francisco. And
Yeah.
eventually, like the boss kept asking, and he told us that the company couldn't understand why we were being so fervent. I think that's the right word. Why we're asking so much about such a nominal amount of money. It was just so insulting because like
Yeah.
that was our
What do
prize.
you think?
Like, I
Yeah.
don't know. So that's the weird conditions we're in. But anyway, yeah, I like lose that job, and I eventually end up taking what I think is a seasonal 6 month job selling tickets at a historical site for the National Park Service at the house where John Adams lives.
John Adams.
John Adams changed my life. John Quincy, you know, but
Oh,
I won't split here hairs at that point. John Adams,
are a
John
historian.
Quincy
You
Adams,
should be
his
splitting
son.
hairs. Yeah,
Yeah,
yeah.
that's true. That's true.
Yeah. And so that was a sweet spot for you. You liked that.
Eventually, yeah, it totally snuck up on me. A lot of people you meet in the Park Service, and again, everything I say here is strictly my opinion. A lot of Park Service staff is made up of seasonal employees. Some say too much. So I'll sell tickets to tourists. In 6 months, you know, you get laid off. I'll move on to something else. It
Yeah.
was decent paying, and I was excited about it because I was raised around Boston history with babysitters and taking us to historical sites. We were just like learning about that stuff. It was
Right.
important to learn about. It was so important to learn about, I didn't realize it. It just was part of what happened. You learned about where the revolution started. I didn't feel excited about it. I thought it was neat. But it was just more something that was alongside us at all times. And
Yeah.
so I could talk about it with these tourists who are really excited to be there. This is just after the HBO series about John Adams. And I'm versed in this stuff. And when I'm not versed in, I just kind of start reading about it. And I have a great boss, a man who changed my life, my boss Jason. And there was another guy. We all just clicked. We worked well together. And I was at that point, my whole life, I was a 15 minutes late to work guy. I was always late for everything. Part of it is just like no motivation, nothing. Jobs never felt natural as I was like regretting having to go there, you know,
Yeah,
somewhat,
I can relate to that.
somewhat at least.
Yep.
You know, selfish or not, but Jason gets on me. So Jason had gone to the Virginia Military Institute. He's a wicked funny guy, and but he would ride our ass like a drill sergeant if we stepped out of line. But he was reasonable, so he sat me down, and he said, "You keep showing up 10 minutes late." So he's telling me that my new start time was 15 minutes earlier. And what he was doing is getting me to show up on time, eventually early. The
Yeah.
earlier I showed up and the more consistently I showed up early, the more privileges he gave me. You know, days
Wow.
off when I wanted, easier schedule. Like, so all of a sudden, I had discipline for the first time in my life. And
Wow.
I was reading more history, and I was engaging with the public, and that place was short-staffed a lot. So I stepped up and said that I would give tours. I started giving tours, you know, and I just, every time I would get a question that I didn't know, gave me something new to look up.
Yeah.
Now, I wasn't reading, I wasn't holding books from the 1700s. Eventually I would, but I'm still going back to the 1700s and trying to figure out what the heck is going on from primary sources as much as I could.
Yeah.
Trying to read secondary history academic sources that like were interesting and boring at the same time.
Yeah.
But I'm holding it all structurally together. And so I'm also not writing. I was just so done. Burnt out with writing,
Yeah.
killing all those books and just being, I wasn't quitting on purpose. It just
Yeah.
fizzled. It just fizzled. But
Makes sense.
eventually, some of that energy went in to showing visitors, showing tourists around, and connecting people with place. The power of
Yes.
place and the power of
Yes.
storytelling
Yes.
became intertwined and are make up the foundation of my life now. Because that
Love it.
storytelling, you know, how I wrote you that poem and it hit you, you would have moments like that. We would all high five behind the, if someone cried on your tour, like out of
Wow.
emotion, like it doesn't happen
Yes.
a lot, and it's like probably more than you, but you know, you're reading the room in different ways, all sorts of ways, and you learn just different stories. It's not stand-up comedy, but you're on the spot. People aren't coming to see you, they're coming to see the place and hear the guy sometimes, and you're the guy, and eventually you figure out where they want the story, where you think the story is. Like where are these important points of humanity, and where you can make those things overlap, but it's always moving because it's in real time, and I just it had that same energy as like the music. It was like playing music
Yeah.
almost, so you had to like listen, like react in real
Yeah.
time, but because you're
Yes.
dealing with these stories, and just like grabbing things from where you can, it had that poetry energy, that alive spirit energy in a way, because you're communing with the past, for better or for worse. And the only way you get good at it is by like failing in all sorts of ways and learning from your mistakes. And I just, for the first time, I felt like I was doing something that I could do. Every job ever had, I couldn't, for the most part, like the bookstore job, if that could have sustained me, maybe I could have done that and stepped up more. But every job that could sustain me that I'd had, I like literally couldn't imagine how I could exist in this world for long. Like, not like I was gonna kill myself, but how could I be alive and still have this job? Like, I maybe would have drank myself to death. Like,
It wasn't electrifying you, but the way you just described, you just like tied it all up from your initial love of music to writing. It's all of them in one. Only you're interpreting stories of people and things that can't talk anymore. And that has purpose. I don't know, maybe that's part of what helps. Instead of just looking at poems and writing and seeing it thrown away, you're keeping it alive all the time by always telling the story. And that power of place in the story from a place that you're from, that's reminding people of where they are. Instead of just moving through the world really fast and not paying attention, you're suddenly where you are and you understand the history and where you fall in that history and then what to do next. You're sharing with everyone these stories and it's taking us to the next step. It's a very powerful job. It's a very powerful thing. It makes a lot of sense that you found your calling here. It's really cool.
It's been great. And agency, and also the ability to try to pass on agency to other people. I'll tell you a story that kind of gets me through, the hard times. So the Park Service has this kids program. It's called the Junior Ranger Program. Every park has it. It's a booklet of activities based on things at the park, things you learn about, and the kids get a badge. And some kids with their families go all across the country doing it. And I was in I like rewarding the kids for their work and also making them have a good time. And there's a swearing in ceremony you do for these things once they complete it. And I just do it real serious, but in a fun way. Just because I want the kids to walk away, with just feeling that it wasn't a waste of their time. So I remember as a kid walking away to so many places, like, I know I'm a kid, but you wasted my time. You didn't act like my time was like fuck you, I'm a kid. But there's this one young girl, maybe 10, and she had done these programs all over. And I swore her in, and she asked about the symbolism on my badge with the arrowhead and the buffalo, and we were talking about that. And I actually hadn't known what all of that meant, but I knew she I could tell she did. So I kind of asked leading questions so she could tell me. I was really impressed. So I went and got her what's called a challenge coin. It's a naval tradition, but we had one for the park. So I told her this is very special just because of all the hard work you did, and I swore her in. I could tell she was really like she was into public land type of kid, just from talking to her about where she's been. Like, she really cared about the parks being for everyone, which is something that all the Park Service, we like to, we're taught to convey the power of place and the fact that this is public land and everyone has agency and this is. on some level, all of ours. You know, there's always uphill problems of making that happen in reality, but it's a mission that's trying to happen, and that's conducted through first preservation. Preservation is the most important, and then second, education. And the reason why those are connected is because you can't have the type of education we do without preservation. So this goes on to say, in this swearing in thing that most kids don't really listen to but have a fun time with, it ends with, do you help to keep these places safe and clean for future generations? And they say yes. And I looked at her and I said, it's my job to keep these places for people like you. I said, but someday it's gonna be your job to keep these places for people who aren't even born yet. And she was just like, she asked, can I give you a hug?
Oh
Like,
my God.
it was just one of those
That's a
things where
yeah.
you just connect with, you know, a human being.
Yes. And you're instead of it being like static books that can eventually be thrown away, you're facilitating a living, I don't want to say document, but like a an alive document in the telling of stories. It's
Yes.
quite magical. Yeah, it's quite amazing. And now you are, tell us where you're living.
Well, sure. So Adams was seasonal, and then I eventually got a job at Boston National Historical Park where I work now, but initially seasonally. So in the off season, I got a job at the Massachusetts Historical Society, the oldest
Okay.
historical society in the country,
Okay.
where, amongst other things, you know, all of the Adams papers are kept there. I've held hair from George Washington.
Wow.
I held bullets, the bullets that were taking out of someone's knee in the Boston Massacre. You talk about power of place, like these are, someone did a DNA on those tests. And this is a plug for Massachusetts Historical Society in about agency. Anyone can go there and research there for free.
It's
You
amazing.
have to take their half-hour training, but then you can be holding documents from the 1700s, from the
That's
1800s.
really good to know.
And I encourage everyone to do that, to use an archive. You can also, they have a lot of free stuff online, masshist.org, but
I'll link it. Yeah.
they were excellent to me. They're great. Very nice people. And they do important things of kind of in line of what I was talking about.
Yeah.
Eventually, I had to leave there. I get picked up by Boston, because I got picked up by Boston National Historical Park full time, finally became a full time federal employee, which I'm very happy about. Took an oath to defend the Constitution against all enemies, foreign and domestic.
Nice.
It's corny, but I take it seriously.
Good for you.
Part of that defense is education. But I, you know, I was still friends with people at Mass Historical, and Mass Historical has a great reputation around the state, around the country, and the world. But a lot of people in Massachusetts local really know about them. And there is a historical house in Reading, Massachusetts. It's built in 1694, called the Parker Tavern, run by the Reading Antiquarian Society. And they needed a caretaker for their house. And they knew folks who work at Massachusetts Historical Society, you know, are likely trustworthy with an endeavor like this. And a good friend of mine, Jen, she now works in a Jewish archive in New York.
Oh, nice.
She was essentially going to get this caretaker position that I have now at the Parker House Tavern in Reading, Massachusetts. And I was jealous. I was wicked jealous. I like, because I've been talking about kind of wanting to do this for a few years. I just thought it was so cool that you could live in a historical house. I had also at some point during this time worked at like Old North Church, and there was a
Okay.
caretaker there, and
Okay.
it just seemed like the cool, it seemed like amazing to me. But
Yes, to me too. I didn't know it was a thing. It's amazing.
seemed like, I don't know, Peter Pan meets
Yes. It's like,
Treasure Island. I don't know, meets
yes. It's just amazing. Yeah.
like Time Machine or something.
Yeah.
So I was like joking, not joking, like, hey, if you don't take that job, I would like to take that job.
Yeah.
She ended up not taking the job for a couple of reasons, and she recommended me, and I was at a point in my life where some things were transitioning, so I was needing a new place to stay, or eventually I would. A lot of things are up in the air. I
Yeah.
don't really quite know what's happening in my life.
Yeah. I remember that.
So I thought, so she rec she gave me the recommendation, and I thought I was coming to the Parker House Tavern to kind of meet these folks who ran the place,
Yeah.
an informational interview, because Jen was one interview away from getting the job. Like, she
Oh,
basically
wow.
had it.
She was close.
And
Yeah.
after kind of looking at my resume and what I had done, and Jen, you know, who's amazing, gave me like a glowing recommendation, it was just clicking. And they were basically like acting like I was kind of going to have the offer. And I was also, because they also took me around the house to show me around. And I don't know what's happened to me, but I'm really into great pine boards. I know how to talk about wood now, like old colonial wood, because working at historical houses, old men are going to ask you, is that wood original? What kind of wood is that? And we would all make fun of it. But I remember how I said, if you get a question you don't know, look it up. That's how you learn things. It's how you
Yeah.
are able to look more professional. And I did. And in doing so, I tricked myself where I'm just old enough now, where I was like, actually, this is this old hardwood that's extinct now is really cool. So going around this house with Everett and Ginny from the Antiquarian Society, I'd just be like, what's this beam? Where's it's like we were just like kind of nerding out together. And
Wow.
it just fit. And now I work with the Antiquarian Society. I'll be giving tours here. Folks are welcome to come by May to October on Sundays from 2 to 5 for free tours in Reading, Massachusetts, Parker House Tavern. But I have the honor and the responsibility of being like, taking care of whatever needs to be taken care of, and being someone who notices something to preserve this place. You know, it
Yeah.
was built in 1694, restored in the 1920s. It's where a Scottish there's a Scottish general. So Boston forces the British out of the colonial militias force the British out of Boston in March of 1776. July, a big British ship comes rolling in, the Scottish general, and he doesn't know that Boston had changed hands. And people in Boston think it's a pirate, they think it's a prank, but it's really this aristocrat, Archibald Campbell, who had helped kill 10 million people in Bengal working for the East India Company previously, was now not only had a regiment of 100 of 1,000 men, but he had 17 servants with him, because he had been told by England that they were going to roll in and they're just take all this land. So be ready to have your estate in order. And they were. Except the British aren't there anymore. It's all the colonial militia. So Archibald Campbell and all his men and all his servants, they all get taken prisoner. Because of the way society worked back then, because Archibald Campbell is an aristocrat, he gets put in a gentleman jail here at our tavern. Now, a tavern isn't like a public house like you know today. A tavern back then gave you license to serve food and drink, but also to give somewhere a place to sleep, almost like a somewhere between a motel and a bed and breakfast. But it was turned into a
Okay,
jail
yeah.
for a couple of years for Archibald Campbell,
Wow.
and he would write angry letters to George Washington and John Adams about how piss poor the accommodations were and how offensive this was. He was really mad because he wanted the town to pay his 17, to pay the salary of his 17 servants.
Oh my
And
God.
the selectman very sarcastically wrote to read him saying, like, hell no, but we will put them to work hard labor for the town if they want money or something.
Hell no.
But he was allowed to walk within a 5 mile radius, and some people liked him. At one point, when there was a selectman vote, three people, he wasn't running, but three people voted for him.
Wow.
I'm hoping that was a prank. Like, yeah, the prisoner in the tavern over there. He's eventually traded for Vermont's Ethan Allen, the Green Mountain Boys. So that's the story of where I'm at, and I get to tell that story, but I also get to tell many, many other stories about Reading. That's the one this place is famous for. But I'm living in a piece of history. You know, we talk about these books that are alive, this music that are alive. It's like there's a house that's literally has is being supported by beams from the 1600s, from a variety of pine tree. That's a hardwood that's so large and was over-harvested, it doesn't exist anymore.
Blows
And
my mind.
it's just and just so many artifacts in the house because it's a collection of the town, basically. So everything, you know, 1600s, 1700s, 1800s, 1900s, you can imagine. And it's, yeah, it's, I kind of can't believe it because I get to live in this house, and then I get to get on the train and go over to Bunker Hill, and I'm at the battlefield, and I get to talk about the regiment of Irish soldiers that showed up on June 17th, 1775, having been at sea for months. They've never fired their weapon before. These young men are handed a gun and forced up the hill at Bunker Hill. It's like
Wow,
I
that's
get to tell
so
those
terrible.
stories, and I get to be in that spot where it happened. And I get to convey it because a lot of times you can't at a historical house maybe, but at an urban battlefield that's been developed, it's like it's story. You have to use story to bring out the power of place. And basically this windy road that I just spent the last however long telling you about, of job to job and place to place, it's all culminated in this. I don't believe in A plus B fate, but you see which way a river meanders, and you know, eventually the momentum of a tide over time like make shapes the land around it, and I feel like I've been shaped by that momentum.
Yeah, it's beautifully said. You've like washed up on shore and now you're kind of like this mix of all of these experiences. Do you have a poem or two you could read to us?
Sure. It's funny reading these. It's like going to another life. But these are, I published a few poems. This is 2012's winter edition of the Inman Review. I
Ooh.
was working at the used bookstore. Looking at these too, I want to start like editing them in my head. Like that brain turns on. Like, oh, I didn't quite get. It's funny. It doesn't. I thought it fizzled out, but it really just it went other places.
And can people buy this book if they want? Like, could I link to it? Like, can you get it purchased, or is that not a thing?
Not that I know of. There might be copies available, you
Okay.
know, wherever weird used bookstores are sold. But this is a Fire Alarm at the Bach Concert. Patrons pour out of the hall while singers harmonize with the piercing tone. Running lights turn on and off as if everyone's blinking in unison, while two ushers work up a sweat, heaving the huge church doors. Behind them, the crowd waits patiently. Above, the organ, smoke eases its way through the balcony.
Wow. Did that really happen, or did you make that up?
Yeah, no, all that is like true. Yeah, I went to see Bach Mass in B minor at a church at Harvard. You know, old church with big doors. And it just, the singers, and my mom, I don't know if it happened all the time, but they knew how to harmonize with the smoke alarm. It's just,
it's amazing. And so I just had this thought while you were reading that. Have you had any impulse to write about the historical stories that you are telling? Have you written any poetry inspired by that stuff, or has that not really happened?
It's not really happened. John Quincy is one of my, John Quincy Adams is one of my favorite historical figures. I've worked transcribing his diaries at Mass Historical. He wanted to be a poet. He felt failed in life. This man had been president. This man had been a senator. This man, spent the last days of his life fighting against some of the slaveholding powers in Congress. Like, he had been diplomat of three places, but he failed because he wasn't a poet. So sometimes I think about him. I think about the son, George Washington Adams, who he dies tragically at a young age, but he was actually a really good poet. Him and his mom are writing poetry back and forth. So,
oh, wow.
I'm not writing, but I'm still connected with those guys and have these, I don't know, conversations. Like, I don't have conversations with many people in history, but something about John Quincy Adams and his son, George Washington Adams, being wanting to be poets and just life happening around them. There's something there. I don't know.
Yeah.
Occasionally I'll jot down things. These days, I don't know. I'm not for or against digital, but I'll maybe do it in like my notebook or my phone. I've been playing music lately and I haven't been writing songs, but I'll be like song title, this or that. So it's there.
Yeah.
And it might come back. It might grow into other things.
Well, I will say, I got to firsthand, me and some friends took a road trip last summer and we hung out with Chris for the day and you took us on a tour of that house and it was poetic. Like listening, I wanted to have you on because listening to you talk about these things is poetic. Like you describe things in this really beautiful way. And so if anyone does happen to be, where is it again exactly?
Reading, Massachusetts.
Reading, Massachusetts.
Yeah,
you
the Parker
look it up.
House
Go.
Tavern.
Parker House Tavern. And I will link to that in Substack.
Yep.
And
yes, Sundays, May to October, 2 to 5.
Yeah, and when I think about when you told us in the beginning how you started out reading poetry in front of people and like just listening to you read now, you're so good at it. You're bringing that skill to this too because you're telling that story. I think you said you can email people the link if they want to hear this, but Chris just hosted a lecture, I guess you'd call it, on the Great Bengal Famine and the Boston Tea Party for the Boston Public Library. Am I right?
That's correct. Yeah.
Did I say that right? Yeah.
Yep.
And it was live on, was it Zoom or something? And like you could click in and I was listening to Chris talk about this subject that he researched himself and I'd never heard him do that before. It was a very cool thing. So if you have any interest in that, people listening to us, you could check that out as well. You can just ask, send us a message. We can send it to you. But
and if anyone has any desire for me to give that lecture for free live over Zoom, if I know you have a community or something, a lot of people haven't talked about the Bengal famine of 1770. And I think India's role and the global role of the American Revolution, but particularly, the Bengalis and some other regions of India as well have been lost and are very important to that story. So I'm also happy to give that lecture for free if anyone would like it.
Yeah. And, also just thinking as we're clearly wrapping this up, when you went through that dark period of the destroying of books without context, when you told this story from this other perspective that a lot of people don't know about, hearing what was going on in India, and you are kind of like you are bringing all of the truths to light. So you're kind of like putting books back together, if that makes sense. Because instead of throwing things out and not knowing the truth, you're bringing, you decided to research this under-researched thing. And that gives us more information, and it gives voice to people who died in that famine, really. Because everyone forgets about them, right? And so, because I didn't know about that. I just knew about the tea getting thrown off the boat. I didn't know about anything else, you know, it was about taxes and tea or something. But there's so much more to it. And there's a lot of gems in there. So it's really worth either a listen or to have Chris come talk.
Yeah, thank you. That means a lot to me.
Yeah. So this was definitely a longer podcast, but worth it, worth every second. So many rich stories and interesting things. Is there anything else that you would like to share before we wind down? Is there anything else you feel like we missed?
No, I think I've gone on long enough, but yeah.
It's been really wonderful having you on. Thank you for joining us. Thank you to our audience for joining us and cozying up to all these stories. Please check out our show notes. I will have links and maybe some of Chris's poems to read and other resources where you can look further. Stay tuned for more storytelling next month. The music we use for our podcast is called Whimsical Aliens. It was written and performed by my friend Alejandro Bernard from Ithaca, New York. And you can subscribe and like his music tutorials on YouTube. You can also become a patron of his work. Currently, this project's being edited by me, Pixie. And thank you all for your support. We will see you next time. Bye, Chris.
Bye. Shout out to Rito. Hi, Rito.
Woo, Rito.